for the most entertaining talk anywhere. Stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station. Your real 24 talk hours of commercial-free programming.
You're listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show. I'm Doug Gefeller. I'll be your host this afternoon. My partner, Rick Franzi, will be back next week, and we'll continue to alternate in hosting the show each week. So today we have two great guests for you to listen to, Joe Orlando of Professional Sports Authenticators and Mike Schmays of Schmays Custom Coatings. So before we start with them, let me tell you that the radio show is really an extension of what Rick and I do when we're not hosting the show. We're business owners, just like many of you listening today, and we've been creating and facilitating CEO peer groups for 15 years here in Orange County, California, all under the banner of Renaissance Executive Forums. That's executiveforums.com. Last year, Rick wrote the definitive book on CEO peer groups with the same title as this radio show, Critical Mass. I'd highly recommend that if you're interested in learning more about these types of groups, that you read the book. It's now in its third printing. You can find it on Amazon.com. Just put in Rick Franzi, that's F-R-A-N-Z-I, under author, and it'll take you right to it. As for me, I'm a master certified coach by the International Coach Federation, the immediate past president of the Orange County chapter, and you can learn more about our coaching practice on our website, thecoachingperspective.com. Well, each week we invite leading business leaders to join us here on the air to discuss what's going on in the business and to share their best practices with us. Our goal is to talk to people who are out there in the trenches dealing with the issues that you and I deal with on a daily basis, particularly in this economy. If you've missed any of our past broadcasts, you can go to latalkradio.com/critical. There you can listen to the shows at your convenience, or you can download an MP3 file and listen to it later on. Well, let me start out with Mike Schmays. Mike founded Painting by Schmays in 1987, which has grown into Schmays Custom Coatings. He's been painting since high school when he was painting cars of friends and has continued to do that. He's received recognition from a number of local national magazines. And his business is really a very unique one in the coating field. And his facility is absolutely gorgeous. He has a wonderful large-scale production facility and a very unique design studio, which I'm sure he's going to tell us all about. So, Mike, we're glad to have you with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell us about your path to Schmays Custom Coating.
The path, okay. So, I owned a body shop, young in life. I was 19. The neighborhood got together, didn't like what I was doing, painting cars in the driveway, and I opened up a small place while I was going to college. And through that, just kind of grew and grew, and eventually I said, you know, this might be kind of good, and I started doing the car thing and body shop work and learning it, and a lot of good folks took me under their wings and taught me how to do, you know, real automotive repair, and pretty soon it grew into Schmays Paint and Body. And years had gone by in that when through a lot of strange turns of events, and I was praying one day about a change in my business, and bam, there it came, a change in my business. Next thing I know, I'm painting some sunglasses and ski goggles, and all of a sudden things are changing quickly, and the body shop is phasing out, and I'm getting into this plastics manufacturing coatings business, where I'm becoming what we now know is a value-added process. And started doing thousands and thousands of plastic pieces, learning that there could be money to be made per piece if you do a lot of them. I didn't know that existed in the car business. And so over the years, we were able to rise to the top of our industry. We painted every BlackBerry in the world here in this facility. We've done work for Nokia and Motorola. We've done work for all the big computer guys. We've done work for a lot of high-profile sports companies that do sports apparel and things. So we've been really blessed to be able to do this type of work with this kind of clientele in a place like this. We eventually installed robots, automated lines, and now we have clean rooms and things in here that we can, you know, do 100,000 parts at a time if we need to.
Wow, that's a fascinating story, from painting cars to high production facility. Mike, can you tell me a little bit, you know, we always ask our guests to share a particular experience and a key lesson that they really learned in their business. What would you like to share with our audience?
Oh, wow. Well, I've learned a couple of key lessons. One, I try to stay focused on my faith through my work, because through all the ups and downs that we have, I hold on to the faith, because I've seen the business come and go and the money come and go. And through that, I've also realized that it's the people that you meet and the people that you get to work with. It's great. You know, we get to meet such great folks working on projects together to meet the deadlines, to get that project out on time, to sometimes, you know, overcome impossible obstacles together with engineers and marketing folks and all of our teams internally here at our place. We all fight together for 3 weeks, 5 weeks, and we get the project out. And I've always noticed that the next project is right there the next day, and the next deadline is just as impossible. And the money is always going to come in somehow, but it's those relationships with the people that you get to, you know, fight in the trenches with that are going to last a long time. And you get to enjoy some time with other folks. You have, you know, common things you're fighting towards together. And sometimes those relationships could last a lifetime. I've met a lot of great people that have influenced me, and my life's a lot richer because of a lot of them.
Great lesson to learn. You know, one of the things that just amazed me when I visited your facility, Mike, was your new design studio. I mean, it just seemed inconsistent with a manufacturing, especially a high-tech robotic manufacturing facility, to have all that space devoted to such a creative facility. Can you tell us a little bit about what your goal was with the design studio and how it came about?
Well, we've been in manufacturing now, I'd say, officially since about 95, let's say, 96. We moved into this building in 2000, so we've been in this 21,000-foot facility for a good 8-9 years, and we've learned that, you know, this economy got hit recently, but I felt the pain 2 years ago, because I started seeing the exodus of all of our manufacturers in America, because I was their painter to a lot of these guys. And they all left for Asia, some India, some Mexico. They all left. And we started feeling and seeing that change 2-3 years ago. And we were hoping to adjust to it somehow, but we didn't really know how to adjust to it. We said, you know, what do? We got all this equipment in here that's designed to do 25,000 parts per shift. And what do we do with this? So we realized through experimenting with some customers' parts that we have a knack for problem solving. We have a knack for creating all new coatings that don't really even exist yet. We have a knack for creating colors to a level where a designer is very satisfied versus just compromising their color just so they can get through the project. And we said, why don't we take all those years of production experience where we've felt the struggle and the pain of production, and why don't we take the knowledge we've learned from that and apply it to creating new finishes that would be easier to produce in production, so they're not as impossible. And it took off. We started doing some work with a very well-known computer manufacturer that's out of Irvine, California. They were able to use our coatings and our designs for our colors in Asia. And that worked out really well. So we said, gosh, how can we do more of this? Not really a consultant's role so much as a workshop, as a design studio, help you create it. And then if you need us to be a consultant for you as it goes overseas, we'll consult and help the group, wherever your contract manufacturer is, to help them launch this product the right way out of the gate, but design it and perfect it here in the States. We wouldn't be able to do a lot of this if it wasn't for a strong strategic partner, and PPG Coatings, PPG Industries, has become that strong partner for us. They saw value in us. They've been a great partner since day one. They've supported this whole view and this vision of what we think the future for us in the West Coast may be, is to help create new things here. We are pretty innovative out here on the West Coast, and we're trying to, you know, make sure that we're utilizing that innovation here to show the rest of the world you can still do these cool things even if you're making stuff in Asia. You don't have to settle for silver or charcoal and everything. And so PPG came in and supported the whole thing, and with their strength, we were able to create products here and ship the formulas to Malaysia or China, wherever it's going to go, and they could produce the same coatings right there with the PPG plants in those countries and supply their coatings from there. And the model seemed to work. So as we started seeing results, we said, gosh, why don't we open up a dedicated design studio for this? So next thing you know, we cut a huge hole in the front of the building, 20 feet in the air, and we built a big glass design studio coming right out of the front of the building to kind of signify something new coming out of something old. And upstairs now we have a 1,500-foot design studio, which is part studio, part laboratory, with liquid coating rooms, powder coating rooms, automated machinery, decoration machinery. We have a great minor sponsor as well. They're called skinit.com. They're a great group of design-oriented guys that have fantastic ideas, even beyond ours. And they're going to come in and hopefully help really fuel the innovative side of what can be done with your products for personalization. I haven't met a group that's got a handle on personalization like Skinit does. I just haven't met one. So with the strong strength of PPG Industries and their global coverage, along with great design from Skinit guys, I think this studio is going to be able to really do a number for anyone that needs help getting their product launched, getting it perfected here in the States, dialing in all the products, and then shipping it off to their country with all the product codes and formulations right in place. So I'm kind of excited about what we're going to be able to do this year and next year.
Gee, I guess I could tell a little bit about that. You're coming right through the mic there on me. That's great. So let me understand. So the design studio really functions in two different ways. One is to develop and help implement new production techniques and new qualities in manufacturing processes that are going overseas, and two, to also provide a in-house opportunity for you to work with a local company and bring your manufacturing people in right off the floor and solve the design production issues right there in real time. Is that, do I have that right?
You've nailed it. Everything from how to hold the part during painting to how many coats of paint it should get for the desired effect to how many different colors you want to create to their limited edition products. Even doing limited edition products here at Schmaes, maybe 10,000 for the year, we'll do that here. Well, they do 100,000 a month in Asia. So we can even help them do limited edition runs with high levels of decoration. We can bring our specialists in from PPG globally. They'll send anyone out here so the chemists themselves can work with the company. So say you're a large computer manufacturer, they'll send three or four of their top guys out. Skinit will send a couple of their top techs out to work with you on personalization. And we'll be able to be there to make sure all the coatings are going to be applicable by robot or by automation, whatever process you need. The coatings are going to be durable. They're being built right. They look right. So,
fascinating.
Like that.
Mike, tell us, what is the smallest part that you've been involved in, and what is the biggest piece of equipment that you've been involved in?
Oh, wow. You know, I've painted a Learjet before. Not inside the building. What we've done, we've really soaked ourselves in electronics as of late. Even though we were doing automotive interior for years for Ford and GM and doing all those things, I'd say the smallest parts you've done are probably cellular phones as a whole. Lots of cellular phone parts. We've done millions of parts for a lot of different companies. The largest item we're currently doing now is we actually coat a product for a large airline, an airplane maker, Airbus. We do an entire interior for them, and it's one of the biggest planes out there. So all the overhead interior parts are painted here robotically, and we can do an entire airplane in one shift now. Where it used to might maybe take 3 to 4 days to do an entire airplane, we can do it all in one shift robotically. And we have very, very high yields doing that. We're hitting maybe 95 to 99% yields every time we shoot one. So we're doing really well with that as well. So, yeah, big to small. I believe it's all in the way you configure the parts, how you present the parts to your painting line. All those types of things can help you get a really big project through here pretty quickly.
And what is the future for these kinds of custom coatings? I mean, where do you see it going?
We've seen such a huge move towards personalization. Of course, with the current economic situation and everybody's fearfulness right now of doing anything, that aside, we've seen a huge trend towards personalization and really upping the ante on the way things look. I don't know how many more times people can keep selling silver or black. It's just black plastic or basic low gloss silver. People are requesting beautiful, deep pearlescent reds, high gloss, and blues. They want piano black finishes. The market is rewarding those groups that are putting those things out. So the ante's been raised. I think, for example, when you see camcorders and cameras, you look at those right now, they're full of codes. They look like a bag of M&Ms out there instead of cameras. They're so colorful and bright. So we see a lot of movement towards color because in the end, color creates passion, and passion creates the sales they need. They got to separate and differentiate themselves from their competitors. So the way it looks and the way it feels to the person is going to be very important. What I mean by feel is we do a lot of soft touch coatings as well that feel softer and more pliable. We have those low gloss coatings, the high gloss coatings, the UV scratch resistant coatings, all those things. So we see a big move towards good looking product.
So you're really, your role is really in response to the movement we're seeing by consumers today to be much more discriminating about the products they buy, to want it to represent them rather than just assembly line kind of looks.
We have seen this for the last 5 or 8 years, maybe 10 years, growing in this direction. Today, to an all-time high, we were involved with the Nokia phones back in 1998, 99 that had the removable face plates on them. And that's when we started saying, wow, we did millions of face plates, and we realized people are buying the heck out of these things. You know, they're just buying one after another, because they love that new look every couple of weeks or every month. They'll change their look on their phone. I think people just want to be differentiating themselves from all the other stuff that they own.
Okay. So basically, you know, your business is really a mix between a creative design firm and a disciplined sort of volume manufacturer. Is that right?
Yeah, we've learned a lot from the great groups we've gotten to work with over the years, automotive, cell phone, all these great groups that we've been blessed to be able to have come in here and audit us. Even though those were torturous times, they were great times because they taught us how to be a high-end producer of products, keep quality systems in place, have a respect for process control. Those are really critical because you can get lots of different people in a room and create some wonderful art. But if you can't duplicate it 100,000 times, you can't play in the manufacturing world. So for us, we found a way to stay artistic and creative, but also be able to take that product and say, let's do this a million times over the year and get a million of these out in the marketplace and do it in an automated sense and keep the cost low. So we've learned it all through all the different groups that we've had the fortune to be able to mix with and learn with and grow with.
I would assume your design capability and your flexibility in production runs has also helped you with a lot of new sort of test product introductions.
I don't understand what the test product introductions means, but I definitely have learned a lot from all the different customers we've got to work with from every different industry. We grow because we get to be involved in automotive and cell phones and ski goggles and helmets and who knows what else, medical devices, things like this. We grow a lot because we get exposed to those groups and we bring all that into one hub here. Then we use it to help our customers in other industries that have unrelated products, and we can help them with advancements or things that we learned through that one project.
Okay. I guess what I was trying to say, I didn't communicate it very well. I'm sorry about that. But was that, you know, for manufacturers who are sort of doing still in the sort of research phase of introducing new products or new looks to products, you're able to do test market runs for them where they can limited quantities. And is that a big part of what you're able to do also?
Yeah, customers come to us all the time to do a run of 10 parts or a run of 50 parts, and they'll have it in 5 colors or 5 effects, maybe carbon fiber on some, burl wood on some, let me see these in a football texture, and let me have 4 in high gloss red and 35 in this color. And they can take those to their own meetings, and then when it gets past their own internal meetings, they can market those in case studies or test studies. And then they could do a 1,000-piece run if they want to, you know, tiptoe into it. Or they can just say, we just need 500 pieces, and that's what we're sending worldwide, and then we're going to make them from there, you know, in production. So, yeah, we can do short runs. We've kept our company nimble and flexible so we can adjust to wherever the customer needs us. We want to meet them where they are. So if they're only going to run 500 parts a month, we're there. If they're going to run 200 parts a month, we can do that. If they want to run 200,000 parts a month, we can do that as well.
Okay. That sounds highly unique, the ability to be that flexible in your production runs. So
it's a little bit of work to stay that way, but we're doing it.
what else you know is going on in your business that you really want to share or talk about here before we kind of wrap it up? I don't want to miss anything here. What else can you tell us?
Gosh, I know we've been having some really tough times as of late. This last year has been really, really grueling and really a challenge for us in a way I've never experienced it. But I know through the tough times, and we've had great times here, you know, where things were great. We've got the highs and the lows, but through it all, I know for myself, I fall back on my faith. I stay strong in it. It's a good way for me to exercise my faith is through my business. So the Lord's given me this company, and I'm able to exercise my faith through it, which is good for me. I get to work out like that. But, you know, I know this. The market's going to change, and as business people, we've got to be able to meet that change. So we're doing things in a completely different way than we were 3 years ago. And it looks like it may work, so we're pretty excited about it. But at the same time, if it doesn't work, we're going to go right back to the drawing board as business people and try something else to make it work. Keep plugging away at things.
Mike, you know, there's a lot of talk recently. I mean, it's been going on for years, but especially recently about can manufacturing stay in California? What's been your experience in working with some of the environmental problems and quality, air quality, water quality problems in a manufacturing environment here in California?
Well, interesting you say that. I'm dealing a lot with the governing agencies this last year with the construction project we've had out. We've had a lot of different governing boards come out for all the permits and all the different things we're involved in, and I never knew how hard it was to build anything like this, real construction on a whole additional, you know, second level place. But I've learned a lot, and I've got to say, over the years, you hear a lot of horror stories about, you know, fire department this or the air quality management district, all these things, and we've been blessed by having great guys in those groups that have really tried to work with us. I'm not saying we've left unscathed. We've had a lot of little run-ins and little things that we've had to deal with, but one thing they've been with us is open and willing to work with us, and you know, we haven't been run out of business by them. They're really trying to work with us to keep us here. Now, it is more expensive, you know, without having me even need to say that. We all know that's true. It's more expensive to be in California doing manufacturing for a lot of reasons, not only the real estate, but the, you know, all the way from minimum wage to all the fees and all the additional taxes we have to deal with. So I've lost a lot of jobs to folks in North Carolina, Kentucky, Arizona, Nevada. We've lost work to those groups because they can do it for less. But a lot of times they may not have the innovative spirit and the innovative knowledge that we may have here of getting a product, you know, to go to another level. But the governing agencies have helped us to stay in business. And that's great, too. I thank them for that because I do hear a lot of horror stories about a lot of groups. And the groups that we've been working with have been good with us. They've, you know, it's not a cakewalk by any means, but they have been good to us and they have been trying to work with us to keep us going every day.
You know, Mike, thanks for sharing that. I mean, you know, so many times in business where we're really motivated for bottom line results, we sometimes, maybe justly so, are accused of not willing to accept change that is really maybe for the social good, better for everybody long term for future generations. And I think that's what we're really dealing with here. And you're hitting it head on. And I think your combination of not just having a manufacturing facility, but also taking advantage of the tremendous design talent here in California to merge the two together, sounds like it's a winning formula for you.
Let's hope. It feels good.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today and sharing your experiences at Schmay's Custom Coating. I would just, you know, I'm sure you'll back it up, but I would venture to say that anybody that wants to stop in and really see what a real integration of design and mass production, robotic production looks like should really visit Mike's facility. I've been out there twice, and it's just absolutely fascinating. So, Mike, before I let you go, how do people get a hold of you?
They can look us up on the Internet. We're at schmaze.com. That's S-H-M-A-Z-E.com. Our number is 714-350-9151, and we're in Lake Forest, California.
Great. Mike,
well,
thanks
Doug,
for being
I
with
thank
us
you
today.
Also. I want to thank you for having me today. Thank you very much.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you. Well, that was really exciting. And again, I would encourage you, if you have an interest in this type of production capability, to call Mike and get out to Lake Forest and visit his facility. It's just a one of a kind, and Mike is a very accommodating kind of guy. I think you'll enjoy it. Well, we're going to shift gears abruptly here today, going from large-scale manufacturing to a totally different environment. We've got the pleasure of being able to talk to Joe Orlando. Joe is the president at PSA, which is Professional Sports Authenticators. He's been president there since 2002. Before that, he was vice president and national sales manager. And he's recently authored or published the book Collecting Sports Legends, The Ultimate Hobby Guide. This is a totally different business. I didn't even know this business existed till I ran into the company a number of years ago and had the opportunity to visit their facility and talk to them. So, Joe, glad to have you here today.
Hey, thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So tell us a little bit. Share with us about your personal path to PSA.
Well, it's quite interesting sitting where I am today. I was actually one of PSA's first customers in the early 1990s. The company was started in 1991, and at one of the trade shows, one of the sports conventions that they would put on in Southern California quite often, I ran into a very, at least at the time, it was a very small table with a gentleman with a handful of brochures that talked about this company called PSA, and sat down and had a conversation with them, and like I said, became one of their first customers. And it was actually during my second year of law school that I was contacted by one of the executives at the company to come work for PSA, and I told him, you know, I think I should really finish this law school thing since I'm halfway through. And when I graduated, I was contacted again, and it was really out of the blue. I had no intention of working at this company or working in the industry at all. And I decided to take a chance because it was something that I had enjoyed in my personal life, and I decided, you know what, this is something I enjoy, and it's a rare opportunity, and I ended up giving it a shot, and that was in the spring of 1999 after I had graduated from law school. So it is sort of interesting now sitting here. I used to be the guy writing the complaint letters to the president, and now I get to field them. So I guess that's what karma is all about. So it's definitely been an interesting path.
It could be karma. It could be, you know, what goes around comes around.
That's right. That's right.
Joe, tell us, explain a little bit about PSA, really. What is it that the company does, and how are you different from your competitors?
Well, what PSA is, probably a lot of people are probably wondering, what the heck is this PSA thing? But what PSA is, we are a third-party authenticator and grader of collectibles, primarily sports collectibles. And what that means is we are not the dealer. We do not buy and sell collectibles. We are sort of the judge and jury. What people do, whether they're collectors, major auction houses like Sotheby's or Christie's, or local dealers, they submit items to us. We not only can tell them whether or not we feel the item is genuine, but we can also grade that item on quality from a scale of 1 to 10. And what that does is it helps facilitate trading and sales in the marketplace because, of course, collectors, the buyers, they feel more comfortable knowing that a third-party expert has rendered their opinion, one that does not have a financial interest in the item itself. One of the problems pre-third-party grading and authentication, if you go back to the 1980s, which most people refer to it as the wild, wild west of sports memorabilia, the problem was if you walked into a convention or a baseball card store or something of that nature, the person selling you the item, the person that has a financial interest in the item, is also the person authenticating it and grading it. So there was a conflict of interest in the transaction. And what we help do is we bring peace of mind to the buyer, but we also provide a much more liquid product to the seller. And one way we differentiate ourselves from our competitors is what we've tried to do over the years is to really become a one-stop shop, to not just focus on one small area or another. So while most of our competitors may compete with our firm in one specific area, we can virtually do it all. And the reason that helps is that most collectors there, and I happen to have some people call it the collector gene or a disease, but I certainly have a little bit of that myself. But most collectors like uniformity. They like to have, they like uniformity of quality, they like uniformity of authentication and grading. So if we can specialize, for example, in baseball card authentication and grading, we want to do that in autographs, game-used bats, tickets, original photographs. The list goes on and on, because that way, if we can reach out and touch collectors of different subject matters, then we can introduce them to the PSA family, if you will, and perhaps when they expand into other collectibles, they'll already be familiar with our name and support our products in some of the other areas that we serve.
So explain for me, Joe, is there a difference between an authenticator and an appraiser?
Absolutely. An appraiser's job is simply to render their opinion as to value. We are the judge and jury when it comes to whether or not the item is real or not. So I guess it would be sort of silly to appraise a Babe Ruth single sign baseball if it weren't real. So we're sort of the in between step. We're the company that people send items to make sure that item is actually the real deal, that they're spending their money on the genuine item.
Okay, so that when you've authenticated that this baseball is real and it's really Doug Gefeller's signature on it, which is worthless, do you attach a value to that then, or do you just verify the authenticity of it?
Well, our job is to verify authenticity, and like I mentioned before, if the customer would like to, we could also render an opinion as to quality. Now, we do provide publications, and we have a website that has price guides and that sort of thing. So we do have price guides. However, we're not making an official appraisal on the item when it's submitted to our company.
Okay. And can you kind of give us a range or some examples? What kind of collectibles are you involved in?
Oh, wow. It's quite a range. Let me tell you. I mean, everything from items that are worth, $15 to $20 all the way up to seven-figure items. I mean, some of the more notable items that our name can be found on is, of course, the $3 million Mark McGwire 70th home run baseball that was auctioned after the record-breaking season of 1998, from the Honus Wagner card from the T206 set, the 1909 T206 set that sold for $2.8 million last year. It's the highest graded example of that card. It was formerly owned by Wayne Gretzky and Bruce McNall jointly, all the way to the first bat, the first home run bat that was used by Babe Ruth on opening day in 1923, to christen the stadium. Of course, they beat the Boston Red Sox that day, but it was the bat that Babe Ruth used to hit that very first home run, and that bat was actually brought back to Yankee Stadium this year on opening day as part of the opening day ceremonies, and that bat sold in Sotheby's about 5 years ago for a little under $1.3 million. So most of our collectibles, of course, do not fall into the seven-figure range, but really, it could be anything from $50 to, $3 million. It's quite a range.
And outside the dollar range, what types of items actually, what collectibles would I bring to you?
Primarily, most of our volume is done in sports, and we authenticate and grade, or items that are submitted to us for authentication and grading, number over 100,000 items per month. Most of it is in sports. It's anything from trading cards to game-used bats to original photographs, autographs, tickets like World Series tickets, Super Bowl tickets, trophies, rings, and awards like Super Bowl rings, Cy Young awards. We do a pretty diverse selection of items, but we also do non-sports items, so historical, entertainment, so everything from Marilyn Monroe to Abe Lincoln. When it comes to autographs, we can service a lot of those, and there are also a lot of non-sports trading cards, that sort of thing, but most of our business is done in the sports field.
Okay. And explain to me, when we were talking earlier, you used the term set registry. I don't know that I understand what that really means. Can you explain that?
Sure. Several years ago, we developed a website program called the Set Registry. And what it is, it's an online venue where collectors of various types of collectibles can not only compete but share in what they're doing. So, for example, if you go to our Set Registry program on our website, there may be a category. Let's take trading cards, for example. 1952 Topps Baseball. If that's the set that you enjoy collecting, what you can do is compete in that category to see how your set stacks up against the best in the world. And so what it does is that it gives the collector a place, a venue online where they can share with other collectors who share in similar interests as they do. And it drives competition. It makes people loyal to our product. It helps the dealers as well, because they're able to sell more product because of the competition. But really, it seems like everyone ends up a winner on this. And the key is the collector, the end user of the product, really likes the program. I like I mentioned before, I was one of PSA's first customers many years ago. And when we developed this, I mean, I thought to myself, this is something that I would enjoy doing. If I were outside the company and collecting, I would enjoy doing this, because it gives me a chance to be involved and share with other people who share similar interests, whether they're right down the street or 3,000 miles away. So that's what the Set Registry is all about. It provides that venue, and there are numerous categories. Up until this day, I was working on a project earlier with the Set Registry. There are over 45,000 registered sets in this Set Registry program. And just to put that in some perspective, our closest light competitor only has about 3,000 on their website. So, and of course, they sort of our competitors copied us very quickly after they saw how successful our Set Registry program became.
So, if I understand it right, then the Set Registry function really allows me as a collector to sort of share my accomplishments with the rest of the community without having to drag it off to a trade show and display it. Is that?
Exactly, and the beauty of it is, yes, and it doesn't cost anything per se to participate on the Set Registry. It's free of charge. The key is you have to register items that have been authenticated and graded by our firm. That way we know, for example, if someone decides to register a set and they say, well, I have the best set in the world, and I think everything is a perfect 10. Well, the way we prove that is, hey, that's what we're here for. That's what we do for a living. So if the items have been certified by our company to begin with, then we know, as the people register their sets, they can actually compare their collections to other collections across really the world.
So this is one of the few places I've heard of on the Internet where I can believe what I'm reading on a website.
That's right. That's because, again, and that it goes back to the concept that we discussed earlier in the conversation, is because it involves a true third party that does not have an interest or a bias, whether you're the dealer or the collector. You know, we render the opinion, and then, again, because we have no financial interest in the matter, it really lends credibility to the product. So, yes, the competition, if there's such a thing, it is a very fair competition in that regard.
Okay. So did the Set Registry come about as really a way to retain your customers and to create a customer loyalty, to sort of establish a brand identity?
Well, yeah, if you go back to the early 2000s when we started the Set Registry, the competitive landscape was much different than it is today. Then there was probably, if I had to guess, there was probably three dozen or so competitors just in, let's say, trading card grading, just in that segment alone. Today there are probably two other competitors that are of any note whatsoever. So at that point in time, we were looking for something to not only
differentiate ourselves from our competitors, but also to it's something where it gets back to the basics. Again, being a collector myself long before I came to work for the company, and I think that has helped in my job here is because I think like a collector and have experienced that before. We were looking for something that wasn't a fad, if you will. It was something that had long-term potential that would increase brand loyalty, and this we felt was the best way to do it. I mean, one thing that we stress a lot around here is that we don't look at our job as simply, you know, the item comes in, we authenticate it, and ship it back out. We don't think that that is the beginning and ending of our role here in the marketplace. We do a lot of other things that help bring in new customers, help build brand loyalty, like the publications, like our website that includes, you know, all sorts of information from, you know, price guides to articles about collecting to guides about what to look for in particular segments of the hobby. So the key is, you know, for us, we felt that this was an example of a way that we could expand the market, bring in more people, and keep them interested. I mean, that's what collecting is all about. It's coming up with a collectible theme and then following through on that theme. It's sort of like a scavenger hunt. There are 100 things I need to complete this list, and the set registry just simply, it formalizes that process. It basically puts it up on a website and says, hey, here's the checklist. These are all the things that you need to complete this particular collection. So if you're interested in something like this, this is what you need to do. These are the items you need to purchase to build this collection. So we do take all aspects of our job very seriously here, not just the authenticating and grading portion of it.
Okay. What do you think is the long-term future for this business?
Well, I think that, well, from our perspective, and I kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, we believe that, you know, knowledge and information is extremely important. The more information we can get out to the public, not only existing collectors, but also potential collectors, the more people will feel comfortable about buying collectibles and more specifically our products. So we try, you had mentioned earlier about this book that we just came out with, Collecting Sports Legends. The idea behind this book is not only to get current collectors to expand their horizons, but to also introduce new people to the hobby. And again, I think part of the issue for collectors is giving them ideas. I mean, that's what it's all about, is giving someone an idea. You know, you know someone's a great football fan and they love watching the Super Bowl every year. They may not realize that you could actually buy collectible tickets from every Super Bowl ever played, that stuff actually exists and there's a market for those products. So we think that there is a lot of long-term upside in this business. It's just a matter of really you know, continuing to get more information out there through the books, through the we have a monthly magazine, again, through the website. That is the key, because sadly, in this business, you know, I've been a part of this business since I was a young boy, and there really is very little when it comes to, you know, books and online information for the new collector. For someone who's thinking about starting a collection, there really isn't much to choose from. So that's part of our job. Our job is to get the word out that this actually exists, and especially when it comes to the high-end product. Every time I meet someone new, someone who's thinking about coming into the hobby, they are astonished at what is actually available. And I'm talking about not the counterfeit items that they hear about on a 2020 or 60 Minutes program, but the real deal. I mean, stuff that you would imagine would be tucked away at the Cooperstown somewhere or in a Hall of Fame museum somewhere. This stuff is actually available for sale. There's a big market for it privately. A lot of people aren't aware of it. So part of it is just bringing awareness to those people.
Fantastic. You know, we've been talking about your business, and it's certainly exciting, and it's, you know, certainly different from many other businesses or services. But when you come right down to it, you're still running a business. How is running this business, the people you deal with, the any different from running any other business? I mean, you've got a bottom line responsibility, you've got financing issues, you've got marketing. How do you handle those things? And are you dealing with them differently because of the field that you're in?
That's a great question. I would say for the most part on the subjects that you just mentioned, yes, like you said, business is business. Many of those things remain the same no matter what business, service or products you're talking about. However, if there's one thing that I would say that distinguishes this particular business from others, is it's highly emotional. What you're dealing with, I would think of it this way. I had mentioned earlier about some of the figures that have been paid for high-end sports memorabilia, and believe me, there are records. We're about to send out a press release soon here. There was another, 1927 Yankee photo that just set a record, over $350,000 about a week ago. So people are paying quite a bit of money for this. So not only do you have the monetary value and the financial component at stake here, but you also have an emotional attachment, which makes it a little bit different. If you're talking about people who invest in things like real estate or invest in stocks, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, it's a very unemotional process. They're buying the stock because they believe it will help make them money. It's that simple. Here, you're dealing with that component, but you're also dealing with people who may be diehard Yankee fans or diehard Lakers fans. So it's the combination of the financial component with the emotional, that sentimental attachment, makes it, I would say, very different from other businesses, because most of the customers that we deal with, at least the people who are buying the product, it can be a very, very emotional experience, especially when you're in the position that we are. And from time to time, I would say oftentimes, we are the bearer of bad news. When someone, submits a Babe Ruth baseball to our company, and they tell us the story about how their father gave this to them on their 15th birthday, and we have to go back and tell them that the ball wasn't even manufactured until 5 years after Babe Ruth passed away, and that it's a counterfeit. Emotions can run pretty high, so there's definitely a sensitivity that you have to bring to the table here when dealing with our customers.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, that I hadn't thought of that, and what a difference it has to make in like you say, in dealing with the customers because of that emotional component. How has the current economy affected your business? I mean, everybody's struggling. Everybody's having to react differently, maybe get more aggressive in their sales. What are you doing differently as a result of the current economy we're dealing with?
Well, I guess I would say, first of all, knock on wood, it has not had nearly as much of an impact as it had in other businesses. We are slightly down, but I mean, it's not, again, like I said, not compared to other businesses. I would say, yeah, we're probably getting a little bit more aggressive on the sales end to generate submissions. Luckily, tangibles tend to stay strong during these types of times, whether the stock market's down and tough economies, because there are people that still have money and they're looking for places to put it. I had mentioned this 1927 Yankees photo just a week ago that sold for a record. I could give you 1,000 other records just like it over the last month or two. So it is quite amazing that even in this economy, in the face of it, that at least the higher end of the products that we service still are setting records. And I think that, again, it just goes to prove that tangibles perform well. Of course, that applies to other things like our sister company, PCGS, which they're the number one grader of rare coins in the world. I mean, so it's one of, I guess I'm very, I feel fortunate that we're in a business that tends to perform pretty well under these circumstances. But I would say if there's one thing that we're doing, we're paying a very close attention to our expenses over the next year. And again, getting a little bit more aggressive on the sales side.
Oh, great. Thanks for sharing that with us. Hey, this has been absolutely fascinating. Before I forget, before we sign off here, how does someone get in touch with you? Give us some phone numbers, web addresses. How do I find out more about what you do?
Well, there's the website, psacard.com. It's just letters PSA and then the word card.com. Or they can reach us toll-free at 800-325-1121.
Okay. Anything that you wanted to say just as we wrap up that I didn't give you a chance to talk about?
I guess the only thing I would add, and I noticed this during the first segment of your program, you could definitely hear it in Mike's voice, is that, you know, if you really love with what you do, you know, you're going to do a much better job at it. And I think when I, you know, came on board here in 1999, it wasn't something I had ever planned on doing, but the fact that I get to work in an industry that I really enjoy, and for a company that I had been a customer of before, and I really believed in their message and in their product, I think it really makes a difference if you have passion for your job. And I know I could hear it in the first segment. Like you said, I think at one point you said it sounded like he was going to come through the phone, but it was obvious that he loved what he did, and I feel the same way about what I do here at PSA.
And Joe, you've expressed it just as powerfully as he has, And you know, it's no secret that what makes people successful is their passion for what they're doing, their commitment, their belief in what they're doing. And you certainly expressed that today. It makes me want to get to know you more, and it certainly adds credibility to your firm. So thank you very much for spending the time with us. We've certainly enjoyed it, and we'll look forward to having you back again another time.
Well, hey, I really appreciate the opportunity, Doug.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Well, thank you for listening. Let me just remind you, if you've missed any of our shows, you have the ability to go to latalkradio.com/critical, and you can download or listen to the shows at your leisure there. But again, let me just thank you, and be sure to tune in next week on Monday at 4 o'clock for more exciting success stories in businesses. My partner, Rick Franzi, will be here. He's got some very interesting guests, and we'll look forward to seeing you with us then. Thank you very much.
Listening to Critical Mass with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller, only on LA Talk Radio.